Every time we go online to socialise or buy something or search something, data is being collected about us. And that is not even the worst part, says Harvard Business School Professor Emerita Shoshana Zuboff. The more disturbing issue is that data is being used to not only predict our behaviour but shape it too. And Professor Zuboff challenges us to better understand how big tech platforms like Google and Facebook have become elephant poachers with our personal data, the ivory tusks. Her book is called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. And Shoshana Zuboff joins us now. Hello there.
Hello, Jesse. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, nice to talk to you. You dedicate the book in part to your children to, quote, fortify your futures and the moral cause of your generation. And what makes this the moral cause of their generation?
Well, you know, I think of it very much like the climate crisis, Jesse. The idea here is that, you know, we've inherited the 2 centuries of industrial capitalism that kind of, while we were sleeping, you know, destroyed the natural ecosystem of the planet. And now we have to scramble to figure out how to correct this and how to avoid the worst consequences of this disaster. And this is a catastrophe that we have bequeathed to our children. And I think the situation we face now in the digital world, and notice I'm not saying the online world, because the digital world extends far beyond the online world. The digital world imbues our daily lives, our homes, our cars, our walk in the park, our evening stroll down the street, just about everything we're doing in health and education and every other economic function, every other daily activity is somehow imbued with the digital architecture. So now this new world of the digital architecture has been commandeered by an unusual, a startling, an audacious, and in many ways a violent new kind of capitalism that I call surveillance capitalism. And it threatens human nature in a way that is somewhat analogous to industrial capitalism's threat to nature itself. And I feel that unless we all gather together and become much more clear-minded about what's happening and what is at stake, then this sadly will be another kind of social legacy that we bequeath to our children, and it will be up to them to ferret out the threads of democracy that are increasingly buried in this new onslaught.
How do you define surveillance capitalism?
Well, you know, there are many ways in which surveillance capitalism diverges from the traditional patterns of capitalism. But to define it for you, I have to emphasize a way that it emulates the historic pattern of capitalism. Mm. So that goes like this. It's not an unusual analysis to say that capitalism evolves by claiming things that live outside the market dynamic, dragging them into the marketplace, turning them into commodities that can be sold and purchased. So famously, industrial capitalism claimed nature for the market dynamic to be reborn as real estate, as land that could be sold and purchased. So when we talk about surveillance capitalism, we see the same pattern, but in this case, with an unusual and disturbing twist. Surveillance capitalism claims private human experience for the market dynamic. And it does this in ways that are both unilateral and secret, hidden from us. So it claims private human experience as a free source of raw material for translation into data, behavioral data. And some of these data are used to improve services. But a great deal of these data are valued for their predictive signals, their rich predictive power. And these data streams are more than what is required to improve services, more than what is required to improve products. And so these behavioral data are a kind of surplus. And this surplus is what surveillance capitalism claims for its supply chains, if you will. It's these rich predictive data flows that they gather into their supply chains, that they convey to a new production process. And this is what we call machine intelligence. Some people like to call it artificial intelligence. And this is a new kind of computational production process. What happens inside that factory? What happens is that trillions of data points are digested every day. And through that computational work, predictions of human behavior are produced. According to a leaked Google memo, I'm sorry, Jesse, a leaked Facebook memo in 2018, one of the rare glimpses inside the black box of this kind of new factory. And what that memo described was, what do we produce in this AI hub, as they call it? We produce, quote, predictions of human behavior, unquote. They write about, as I mentioned a moment ago, trillions of data points being ingested every day. And then they identify the capability that they had achieved by 2018, which was the prediction, predictions per second, the volume of predictions per second, 6 million. 6 million predictions of human behavior per second being produced by these computers.
Yeah. And so, what I find most fascinating about your work is that it's, you know, where people tell us to get up in arms about companies selling our data and breaching our online privacy, but you almost feel like we're putting our outrage into the wrong place. There's a much bigger problem, and that's these companies not just predicting, but also trying to affect our future.
All right. So you've raised such good questions. Let's follow that up a little bit. We have 6 million predictions of our behavior coming out of these machines per second. Where do they go? Well, these predictions of human behavior are being sold, not to us, but to business customers who have an interest in knowing what we will do in the future. And they're seeking certainty. And so the companies actually sell these predictions to business customers in a new kind of marketplace that trades exclusively in human futures. And of course, the big famous original experiment in this was online targeted advertising, where the click-through rate was the prediction of human behavior. And those online targeted ad markets were markets that trade in these behavioral futures. Now, when you focus closely, as I have done, on the competitive dynamics of these markets, how do companies that are trading in human futures compete? Well, they compete on the quality of their predictions. The best predictions approximate certainty. That's really where the arrow is pointing toward certainty. And in order to achieve certainty, if you deconstruct, you know, I think of it as reverse engineering these competitive dynamics. And when you do that, what you begin to learn about are the economic imperatives that drive the operations of this whole thing. And a couple of things are immediately clear. First of all, if you're going to get certainty out of the machines, you need to feed them a lot of this behavioral surplus. They need a lot of predictive data. So economies of scale. But then they realize that volume is great, but it's not enough. They also need varieties of data, varieties of predictive data, not only from online, but from the real world and all the things that you do and say in your daily life. So we have scope, scale and scope. But the third phase of these competitive dynamics, they realize that the very best predictive data comes from actually intervening in human behavior and shaping it toward those directions, toward the directions that lead to the outcomes that will be most profitable for them and their business customers. So this introduces a whole new world. This is what I call economies of action. The idea that this whole digital architecture now is not only being used to monitor, to know, to gather information, but rather to actually feed back to us specific kinds of cues, specific kinds of rewards, specific ways of tuning and herding us one by one, but also at the scale of large groups and cities and populations in order to shape and modify our behavior toward the ends that meet their commercial goals. This is now baked into the cake of what we're calling, you know, the dominant capitalism of our time. Mm. The dominant capitalism of our time trades in our futures, and as a necessary consequence of that, has to construct elaborate, complex, often experimental systems of behavioral modification at scale in order to be successful.
If you've just tuned in, I'm speaking with Harvard Business School Professor Emerita Shoshana Zuboff, whose book is called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. So we understand, Shoshana, that they're making predictions. We understand that they are trying to lead us towards certain outcomes. And what are we losing?
Well, that is the big so what in all of this, Jesse. What are we losing? I was watching a film today. It's a film that was made in 1968, and it was about B.F. Skinner, who of course was the father of behaviorism and invented the concepts and operations of behavioral modification long before there was a digital technology to make it all come to life at this kind of scale. And there's this wonderful film. It was made by the BBC, and the great historian Lewis Mumford is speaking on this film. And he's referring to Skinner's behavior modification ambitions for the total social control. He refers to it as hell, but then he says it's the worst kind of hell because it's a kind of hell that you don't even know you're in it. And this is very apropos, this comment of his. He was, of course, such an insightful man. Very apropos of the situation that we're in today, because these systems are being constructed around us. They're being constructed experimentally. We saw early phases of this experimentation in Facebook's massive scale contagion experiments, 2012, 2013, where they used subliminal cues online to see if they could change people's voting behavior and later their emotional feelings, their sadness or their happiness. They discovered that they could do it. In another massive scale contagion experiment, they tried to see if they could get more people to go vote in the midterm elections in 2012. They discovered that they could do that too. And when the scientists wrote up these experiments in scholarly journals, they celebrated two things. One is that they could use subliminal cues in the online environment to change and modify direct real-world behavior, number one. Number two, that they could achieve that while bypassing our awareness. undetectable, indecipherable. We never know that they are there. Ergo, the surveillance in surveillance capitalism. So when you ask, what are we losing? Let's look at what we've just described that we are losing right now. First of all, we're losing that most elemental right to agency, to human agency, the idea that our energy, our choices, our promises, our commitments that rise up from within us determine the directions that we go in and the choices that we make and the things that we do and the people that we're with and so forth, that these are not compelled through hidden systems that we cannot detect and therefore we cannot combat. So this elemental sense of agency, which is of course at the root of what we call things like human autonomy, self-determination, free will, all of those things without which a democratic society is simply impossible to imagine. So that's what we're losing, you know, right at the core of our everyday lives. This is not something abstract. But now, what are we losing as a society? Well, when we think about they're unilaterally taking our experience, they're turning it into data, they have a unique purchase on the computational capabilities that can crank on trillions of data points every day and produce 6 million predictions per second. Very few entities have that capability. So here we are, all of us together in the 21st century that we entered with such a belief in its promise of a more bountiful, more democratic future in which knowledge and information would be shared and there would be so much more opportunity for all of us. Now we see that as we embark upon the third decade of this century, we're actually moving into a societal pattern that is deeply anti-modern, pre-modern, that reverts back to something that we might associate with the pre-Gutenberg era, when only a few people had all the knowledge, and most people were excluded from that knowledge.
Yes, I've got to say, by the way, Shoshana, that it's quite scary hearing you talk. And I understand that you, a couple of times when you were doing the research for this book, just started screaming.
It's funny that you bring that up. I was talking about that with my kids last night. Yes, because I spent many years deep into the research for this book, Jesse, and sometimes I'd be in this house alone. Sometimes one of my children would be somewhere in the house, but there, as I'd be, you know, reading speeches and watching videos and reading marketing conference calls and the investment conference calls and putting together the pieces bit by bit and building the picture. It's like when you're doing people who like to do those really complicated jigsaw puzzles, you know? And then all of a sudden you get a corner and the whole pattern suddenly comes together and there's a sense of, holy smokes. Well, that would happen to me fairly frequently and I would literally sit in my chair and just start screaming when I suddenly saw a pattern clearly and had all the pieces, you know, to give evidence of the pattern, not just making it up in my head, but all the pieces fitting together. And yes, I'm afraid I did that more than once over the years. Yeah. And sometimes what I screamed was not too pretty either.
But there's so much in the book and, you know, for people like me who studied Marx at university 20 years ago, it's good to have a look at this book and get the updates. And we're just about out of time, so can you spend the last minute or so, Shoshana, telling us what can we do, what should we do?
Yes, absolutely. Look, the first thing is nobody should feel depressed about this. Nobody should feel helpless or resigned. This has nothing to do with digital technology. This is an economic logic that has hijacked the technology that continues to offer great promise to our societies and our civilization. So no room for helplessness and resignation here. Number two, these last years, these last decades, the regulatory regimes in our countries have been dominated by economists. But now we're facing a form of capitalism that is a direct threat to democracy. And that means that as we move into a new regulatory phase, because these things change across the centuries. Early in the 20th century, it was the progressives and the muckrakers who led the regulatory vision. And then later, it was the lawyers and the legislators. Then it became the economists. But now I believe we are reverting to a new regulatory era. And it will be warriors for a democracy under threat who form this new vision. I mean lawmakers, I mean citizens, I mean specialists, banding together to reclaim the digital future for a democratic future, for the kind of values in society that we seek. And if there, you know, when we think about the surveillance capitalists and the tech giants, we think that they are very wealthy and very powerful, and of course they are. But there is one thing they fear, like in those old movies, you know, where you've got the vampire coming and somebody puts up a cross, you know, to ward off the vampire. There is one thing they fear. They fear law. They fear democracy. They fear lawmakers. They fear citizens who will not accept anything less than democratic control of our own societies. This is what they fear. And so, in fact, we have the power. Our lawmakers have the power. We've been reluctant to use it because we have been sold on this misguided idea that, you know, law and regulation will somehow reduce the innovation of these companies. You know, we've thought that these companies were innovative companies that occasionally made dreadful mistakes that violated our privacy. And it's taken us all this time to realize that those mistakes are the innovations.
I'm going to send people to the book. It's called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. And thanks for finishing on a note of optimism, hope. Harvard Business School Professor Emerita Shoshana Zuboff, real pleasure to speak with you today. And thank you for all the work you've done on this, all the late night screaming. It's appreciated.
Thank you so much, Jesse. It's a pleasure.